is Friel versus Legal Helpers debt resolution.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Brian Graff. I'm with Ryan Swanson, and we represent the appellants in this case.
All the appellants?
All of the appellants, correct. There is one appellant.
What is the effect
well,
of the...
Well, before we get started here, how much time do you want to save for rebuttal?
2 minutes for rebuttal.
2 minutes, thank you.
What is the effect of the filing the petition of bankruptcy?
Your Honor, my understanding is that the filing of bankruptcy of appellant, the Mortgage Law Group, LLP, stays the proceedings with respect to that debtor. I did some quick research to try to figure out whether or not there was a stay that would apply to all of the appellants in this case. The closest case that I located was Hamel Schwoltz versus County Place Mortgage Limited, 406 Federal Appendix 906. It's a Fifth Circuit decision, not a Ninth Circuit decision. It's the closest one I could find dealing with a stay under 362 in connection with a motion to compel arbitration. And the Fifth Circuit wrote, however, it is well established that the protections of Section 362 neither apply to co-defendants nor preclude severance. Thus, the district court did not err in compelling arbitration. In that case, it was compelling arbitration, not reversing an order denying arbitration, which we're asking for here. It's the closest case I could find.
This wasn't brief, but I am aware of a Ninth Circuit case that holds differently. But why don't you proceed with your argument?
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. I apologize. And I would say, to Your Honor's point, it does trouble me that, in looking at this, that a decision going forward with respect to whether or not to affirm or reverse the trial court's decision compelling arbitration would, I think as a practical matter, decide this issue for the Mortgage Law Group as well. I don't know how you segregate that or separate that. So I certainly it would seem to make some sense to have a stay apply. I apologize that I was unable to find the Ninth Circuit authority on the issue. We are asking for the trial court's order denying the motion to compel arbitration to be reversed. I want to spend some time, as much as I can, on the issue of procedural unconscionability because I think that's the thorniest issue here. The Friel's argument, the respondent's argument, as I understand it, is that it's a requirement of attorneys in all cases that they fully inform clients of all the advantages and disadvantages of arbitration if they're going to put an arbitration clause in an attorney retainer agreement.
Do you disagree with that?
I do disagree with that, Your Honor.
On what ground?
There's no such requirement, we submit, Your Honor, imposed by Rule of Professional Conduct 1.4b. There's no the authority cited is RPC 1.4B, RPC 1.5A9, and the law of procedural unconscionability. Of course, there are also two advisory ethics opinions that I'll address here in a moment. The standard under 1.4B, if it is applicable to prospective clients, and we submit that it's not, that it's applicable to current clients and not prospective clients, but if it is applicable to prospective clients as well, requires only that an explanation be provided to the extent reasonably necessary to permit the client to make informed decisions. That is a much different standard than saying, even if the client doesn't need additional information to make an informed decision, we are going to put an affirmative duty on attorneys to fully explain all the advantages and disadvantages of arbitration. without looking, for instance, with respect to whether or not the client understands fully the arbitration clause, knows that in arbitration a decision is made by an arbitrator, not a jury. In the absence of any showing, there's no evidence here that the Friels had any questions whatsoever concerning the arbitration clause, that they did not understand each and every word in the arbitration clause itself. The only allegation is here, it wasn't explained to me. It wasn't explained to us separately from the disclosure in the writing in the arbitration clause itself. That is not a requirement we submit that is imposed by RPC 1.4B. It's not a requirement under RPC 1.5A9 either. RPC 1.5A9 deals with disclosures and what the obligations are in terms of fees and setting fees and making sure fees are reasonable in attorney retainer agreements. 1.5A9 specifically is a factor that's to be considered by a court in assessing the reasonableness of a fee charged. It's not an affirmative disclosure obligation to fully inform a client of every material obligation or provision in an attorney retainer agreement.
Do you think an arbitration provision in an agreement between a client and counsel is a material term?
Yes, I do, Your Honor.
Do you believe it's a material term? Counsel should discuss with the prospective client whether or not, for example, in an arbitration, you waive the right to a jury?
I think it's two, if I can respond to that with, I can't give you a yes or no answer. Do I think they should, ideally? Yes. Do I think, Your Honor, that it is a requirement that that disclosure be made in each and every instance? No. Do I think that under the...
Is there any evidence in this record to indicate that the prospective clients of Friels had legal training or had any understanding of what arbitration means, pros and cons?
There's not, and part of the reason is because given the procedural posture of this case, of course, there's been no discovery at this point.
My understanding of the record is that they were sent a bunch of papers, asked to sign them, and as I recall, were told if they had any questions, get back to me.
Your Honor.
Is that a fair assessment of what the record shows?
They were. They were sent a package of materials. It included an attorney retainer agreement within the package of materials. The retainer agreement was set forth clearly. We submit it was a clear provision. And it is true, and my understanding is that the Friels reviewed the papers, signed where it was appropriate, and sent the materials back, Your Honor. Yes. So if the disclosure obligations, the alleged disclosure obligations, don't come from the RPCs, where do the Friels turn? Where do the appellants turn? They turn to the advisory opinions that were issued before Concepcion. And the questions, I mean, the interesting questions being posed in the attorney advisory opinions at that time were even, is it permissible? Is it even permissible to put an arbitration agreement in an attorney retainer provision? Now, we know after Concepcion, that question is clearly, yes, you can't say some classification of claims can't be arbitrated under the FAA. So, unsurprisingly, the attorney ethics opinion say, yeah, we're not going to give an outright prohibition on arbitration in attorney retainer agreements, but if we're going to allow you to do it, it's only going to be allowed after full disclosure of every advantage and disadvantage of arbitration, which we submit is specifically targeted to and reflects judicial hostility towards arbitration. Still, we still don't trust arbitration as a means of dispute resolution.
You said, though, that you thought it would be a good practice to disclose to clients, and if you were, what a lawyer should do, what do you think a lawyer should say, even if it's only a best practice? What do you say to the prospective client about the pros and cons of arbitration?
Your Honor, respectfully, I think it depends upon the client. It depends upon the client's...
Isn't this a client that you don't really know, the lawyer didn't really know them?
That is true. In this circumstance, that is true, that it was a brand new client relationship. You know.
Doesn't that matter? Even if one were to say, well, it's variable, but I mean the thing is that I guess what you're saying is that you might have a client that you've had forever and you've talked to them about arbitration and not arbitration on many instances, and you know that they're really familiar with it, maybe even more than the lawyer. But But we're talking here about a situation where people are just kind of sent a packet of stuff. You don't know them. Why is that not, just as a matter of law, a situation that requires some disclosure about, I mean, to say it doesn't would be to say that arbitration isn't really a material term of the agreement. Or are you just saying that the layperson should be objectively expected to know by themselves without any explanation what the pros and cons of arbitration are?
Your Honor, I'm not saying that, but I am saying, similar, I think, to what Judge Jones recently said in the Mann Law Group versus DigiNet Techs case, that was the supplemental authority that we provided, that I think in order to invalidate an arbitration clause, to invalidate it based on a failure to disclose, the burden is on the person. We have a strong presumption in favor of arbitration. So the burden is upon the person seeking to invalidate the clause to show that, you know, it was not reasonably disclosed in a manner that they could make an informed decision. I think that burden is placed upon the person contesting the arbitration clause to make that showing. In this case, of course, we never got a chance to get down that road. We haven't gotten a chance to go down that road in arbitration yet. But I think it's an individual determination that has to be reflected in what's the level of sophistication of the client? Have they been in arbitration before? Do they know what arbitration means? Do they know that arbitration doesn't include a right to a jury trial or, you know, limited discovery rights to the extent there are limited discovery rights under the applicable arbitration rules? All of those things. I think
okay, counsel, you have your rebuttal time. 2 minutes.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Erica Neusser, and I represent James and Deborah Friel. And I just wanted to address really quickly the bankruptcy issue. We had assumed that that was a stay only applicable to the defendant in bankruptcy, and so we didn't actually look further into the issue, but we'd be happy to do so and submit additional authority to the court or briefing if that's an issue that you have a concern with. So I am just going to jump into the procedural unconscionability issue.
Well, before you do, opposing counsel has cited a case from the Fifth Circuit, so I guess you do need to not provide us with supplemental briefing, but perhaps supplemental authority on that issue.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. So with respect to the procedural unconscionability issue, the Superior Court properly determined that LHDR's arbitration provision fails Washington's procedural unconscionability test. Even after Concepcion, such generally applicable contract defenses are applied to invalidate arbitration clauses. Indeed, here we need look no further than the Ninth Circuit's decision in Smith versus Gem Group. And in that case, it involved the exact same defendant, LHDR, and it involved an attorney retainer agreement entered into with an indebted Washington consumer, and it involved the exact same arbitration provision. In that case, the Ninth Circuit held that the manner of entering into that agreement did violate Washington's procedural unconscionability test for the very reason that we're arguing here today. Under Washington law, procedural unconscionability relates to impropriety during the process of forming a contract, which is determined in the totality of the circumstances. So, yes, it does depend on the client. And if we look at the client and the totality of the circumstances here, we see that Washington's test is not met.
Now, there's been a reference to a supplemental authority that was submitted concerning a case that I believe Judge Jones did.
Yeah.
Can you address that case?
Absolutely. So in that case,
what is the name of that case?
Mann Law Group, I believe.
Okay.
Versus DigiNet Techs.
Yes. DigiNet Tech, exactly. So in that case, I think it's a very important example of the totality of the circumstances, which Judge Jones did an excellent job of comparing to the totality of the circumstances in the Smith case, the Ninth Circuit case, which is very similar to here.
So it's distinguishable?
It's very distinguishable, Your Honor. So in the Mann case, the arbitration clause appeared in one of 12 paragraphs in a 6-page contract. There was no evidence that the contracting party, a sophisticated company represented by both its CEO and COO, had not met with their attorneys. But most importantly, the arbitration agreement itself specifically made disclosures regarding the arbitration clause, including, and I'm going to quote, the waiver of the right to trial by jury, or to conduct discovery, or to appeal. And then it went on to highlight the arbitration agreement as a provision that by itself required the advice of independent counsel. We have none of those factors here. Here, American Platinum, a separate company, emailed LHDR's attorney retainer agreement to plaintiffs as part of its standardized loan modification packet. American Platinum directed plaintiffs to sign that document, and plaintiffs returned that document to American Platinum. In addition, I think it's important to note that if you look in the record, the attorney retainer agreement is signed on December 6th, and that's in the clerk's papers at 26 through 35. The representation that LHDR made, which didn't actually come from LHDR but also came from American Platinum, that the plaintiffs could ask any questions that they have, that was signed on December 20th, and that's in the clerk's papers at 189 through 90. Then, in addition, we have a very unsophisticated Washington consumer. We don't have a CEO and a COO reviewing an attorney retainer agreement, something that they've probably done in the past, likely to know what arbitration is. And finally, the arbitration clause at issue here does not make any disclosures like the arbitration clause in Mann. It doesn't say that you lose your right to a jury trial. It doesn't say that you lose your right to discovery. It doesn't say that you lose your right to appeal. So I think that case is very distinguishable. So here the totality of the circumstances reveal that LHDR violated Washington's rules of professional conduct. Washington's RPC 1.5 requires attorneys to give clients a reasonable and fair disclosure of all material elements of the fee agreement. All material elements. And here we have counsel admitting that, yes, arbitration is a material element. With respect to arbitration clauses, the Washington State Bar Association advisory opinion also indicates that we should be giving our clients full disclosure of arbitration clauses if we're going to include those in our attorney retainer agreements. This is not hostile to arbitration clauses. This is the same requirement that attorneys have when discussing any material term in their attorney retainer agreement. If an attorney wants to charge their client a contingent fee, that's a material term. They need to explain to their client the difference between a contingent fee and the difference between an hourly fee. That's all that needs to be required here if you're going to include an arbitration clause as well. RPC 1.4 provides an additional basis for concluding that disclosures were required here. RPC 1.4 requires that a lawyer shall explain a matter to the extent reasonably necessary to permit the client to make informed decisions regarding the representation. And now defendants argue that on the first time, in reply, that this rule has no application here because it applies only to current clients. I don't think that argument holds any water, but more importantly, just this month on April 8th, in Gordon versus Lloyd Ward and Associates, and that was submitted as supplemental authority, Division 3 considered a nearly identical issue and a nearly identical fact pattern and concluded that RPC 1.4 is applicable and that a lawyer who creates a relationship with a client is bound by the rules of professional conduct, including the duty to advise the client, and I'm quoting from the case here, when the client is entering into an agreement that may limit his or her rights. The attorney retainer agreement at issue here is just such an agreement. And as in Smith in the Ninth Circuit, and similar to Gordon, the arbitration clause in that agreement is procedurally unconscionable because LHDR failed to fulfill their fiduciary duties as attorneys. I want to turn to the last issue here, which is the non-signatory issue.
Do we reach that if we were to affirm the trial court?
If you affirm the trial court, no, you don't need to reach that issue. If you find that the arbitration clause is procedurally unconscionable, then the non-signatory defendants don't get to enforce it, period, because it's an unconscionable arbitration provision. If you were to find otherwise, then the non-signatory defendants are also not entitled to enforce it under well-established Ninth Circuit precedent, including a recent case from 2013, Rajagopalan versus Noteworld, where the Ninth Circuit indicated that it had never allowed a non-signatory defendant to use equitable estoppel to apply an arbitration clause against a signatory plaintiff. And we would ask the court to do the same here.
If we got there.
If you got there. And we hope that you don't. For these reasons, plaintiffs respectfully request the court affirm the Superior Court's denial of defendant's motion to compel arbitration in all respects. Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you. I'd like to address counsel's discussion, if I can, of the Mann case. And I think Judge Jones's discussion in Mann is important. Judge Jones wrote that Washington cannot, consistent with the Federal Arbitration Act, impose a higher burden of disclosure for arbitration clauses in fee agreements than it imposes on the remainder of the agreement. An attorney must disclose the arbitration agreement only to the same degree that he or she must disclose all material terms in any attorney-retainer agreement. In other words, an attorney is no more obligated to provide disclosure beyond the terms of a clearly worded arbitration agreement than she is to provide disclosure beyond the terms of the remainder of a clearly worded fee agreement. The appellants respectfully submit that what is being argued here and demanded at the risk of invalidating an arbitration clause is just such a heightened standard. There also are other clauses that are material,
well,
of course.
Is your position then that the a lawyer can enter into a contingent fee agreement with a client without explaining what it is?
No, Your Honor. And specifically,
but wouldn't
rule,
Judge Jones's opinion suggest that perhaps if the arbitration agreement itself went into detail and explained all the pros and cons of contingent fee agreements, that might satisfy?
There is a heightened elevated disclosure obligation with respect to fees.
The distinction that's being made with the case that Judge Jones wrote is that in that case the agreement went into detail about the pros and cons of arbitration, whereas yours does not.
It went into additional disclosures. That is true, but it's not that. I submit that is not the basis upon which Judge Jones made his determination.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The next case is.